When I interviewed at my seminary as part of applying to their program, one of the minister professors on the panel, Nan Hobart, noticed a gap in my resume. 8 years between high school graduation and the beginning of college. Yeah, and she asked me what I was doing during that time. I told her I had attended a local college right out of high school and dropped out, and simply worked for those 8 years, and that it was during that time that I discovered what it was I was interested in and figured out how to pursue it. She then asked me what led to my decision to drop out the first time. I couldn't see any way around the truth about this time in my life that I felt some shame about, so I told her. I was disappointed in my general liberal arts program, and I discovered partying around the same time. The partying and the recreational drugs and the related unhealthy choices distracted me from schoolwork, and I flunked out. And I told her about my path back to college and my career in plant ecology, how none of it was planned, really, but more of a process of finding out what I resonated with over time and letting that guide me to the next thing. And that my desire to attend seminary, my call to ministry, was also unformed in that same way. I didn't have a plan for my ministry. I didn't know what it would look like. This felt like a huge risk. Surely the seminary would not want someone who had made such bad choices and who didn't have a path mapped out for their career on top of that. But instead of ending the interview then and there, which is pretty much what I expected, without batting an eye, Nan asked me another question. What did you learn from that experience? I don't really remember what I said. I do remember how I felt. I felt seen, and I felt welcomed for who I was and what I brought to this place and this conversation. In hindsight, knowing what I know now about Unitarian Universalist history and theology, her response, I know, was deeply rooted in our faith tradition. We believe in redemption as part of our Universalist heritage. The original theology, when Universalism was a Christian tradition back in the 1800s, was that if God really made us in their image and loved us with a parent's love for their child, then it was inconceivable that they would send anyone to hell. And so, hell must not actually exist. Today's Universalism in our faith tradition has less of an emphasis on God's grace for us, as we're no longer a Christian tradition, and more of an emphasis on our grace for each other. Today's Universalism calls us to believe that everyone is more than the worst thing that they have ever done, in the words of Brian Stevenson, the public interest lawyer who has dedicated his career to helping poor people, incarcerated people, and people sentenced to the death penalty. We get there to grace by recalling our own worst things we've ever done, like the impact of those bad choices during that partying phase, the impact of those choices on the people who loved me, which offers us the ability to imagine others getting into that place in their lives. Remembering our own stories gives us the power to offer grace and redemption in a world where everyone messes up and does harm in some way. And telling our stories invites us into humility, where others can offer grace and redemption to us. And telling our stories, especially the ones we feel shame about or think people will judge us harshly for, is a risk, even more so when we have no power. None of the power in that interview room belonged to me, until Nan Hobart offered me a chance to open to vulnerability and share my story. She gave me the power to lead the conversation with vulnerability and openness. I didn't just feel seen and welcomed in that room. I felt empowered to step out of the shame I had felt and share something real and true about myself toward the goal of building a relationship. Another world was possible. I read a lot of speculative fiction, a sub-genre of science fiction that focuses on building possible worlds. Much of what I read is actually dystopian fiction, works whose settings are during or after some kind of apocalypse. And yes, I know, I can just open the paper. Like Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, which is getting a lot of attention these days because despite being written back in 1993, it describes a world much like the one we are on the brink of, and it's set in 2024 and 2025. Climate change, yeah, right? Climate change has left California dry as a bone in this book, and the protagonist actually writes in her journal for February 1st, 2025, that there is a fire in her town, and what a danger that is. There's a class of ultra-rich people who have secured their own safety, a class of poor people who are left to fight over what is needed to live, and very few people in between. Violence, disease, constant threats to survival are a way of life for those poor. And there is a political party in charge that feeds these disparities, and a president whose slogan actually is "Make America Great Again." Yikes. Read it. Yup. Octavia Butler wrote this still relevant reflection in the year 2000. So do you really believe that in the future we're going to have the kind of trouble you write about in your books? A student asked me as I was signing books after a talk. The young man was referring to the troubles I had described in Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, novels that take place in a near future of increasing drug addiction and illiteracy, marked by the popularity of prisons and the unpopularity of public schools, the vast and growing gap between the rich and everyone else, and the whole nasty family of problems brought on by global warming. I didn't make up the problems I pointed out. All I did was look around at the problems we are neglecting now and give them 30 years to grow into full-fledged disasters. Okay, the young man challenged. So what's the answer? There isn't one, I told him. No answer? You mean we're just doomed? He smiled as though he thought this might be a joke. No, I said. I mean there's no single answer that will solve all of our future problems. There is no magic bullet. Instead, there are thousands of answers, at least. You can be one of them, if you choose to be. Several days later, by mail, I received a copy of the young man's story in his college newspaper. He mentioned my talk, listed some of the books and the future problems they dealt with. Then he quoted his own question. What's the answer? The article ended with the first three words of my reply, wrongly left standing alone. There isn't one. So the student tells a much different story than the one Octavia Butler was telling. Her story was one of empowerment. There are thousands of answers, and you and you and you and you can be one of them. While the student's was one of disempowerment. Another world is possible only if we believe it's possible, and if our stories are of that possibility. We can claim our power, and we can empower others with those stories. Friends, the story we are in now is a hard one. A hard one for those of us and our siblings who lived in marginalized identities, and those of us who care about freedom and equity for all. One of the dangers of this time is that we are going to be pushed by this administration into feeling powerless. We are going to be, and in some ways we, and I mean the larger we here, I don't mean this congregation, we're going to be, and in some ways we are already being, pressured to obey in advance. The historian Timothy Snyder's term in his 2017 book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Obeying in advance means giving power to authoritarianism by adapting to the conditions it imposes before the consequences of agreeing to them will impact us personally. Like ending an article with, "There isn't one answer," instead of, "There isn't one." There are thousands, and you can choose to be one. Or like not voting because it won't make a difference anyway. Or like choosing not to publicly hang a statement of some kind supporting marginalized communities, or even taking statements down, or anything else that is an act of refusal to try to resist tyranny. We're going to be pressured to give up the rights of others to secure our own safety. I strongly believe that one of the ways we can push back against this is to keep building a community in which there are no others. One of the ways we do that is, yes, by sharing our stories, and also by making spaces where people who will be unsafe in the times to come might share their stories. I went to the People's March here in Madison yesterday. It struck me that the organizers know this. Chants and speakers supported women's rights, workers' rights, abortion rights, transgender rights, immigrant rights, global solidarity, peace, environmental justice. The speakers holding marginalized identities told their stories and stories from their communities. And there was joyful resistance interwoven with these powerful stories throughout the day. The raging grannies sang. Local drag queen and activist Sunshine Rainbow read some of their poetry and performed. There was another drag performer and a burlesque dancer whose names I can't remember. These artists showed us the beauty and power in people simply being themselves. Maya Cullen, one of the speakers, said in an interview, "Entering these next few years, when it feels like change is impossible, or like we're drifting away from home, I just want people to understand that we can't lose our voices, because it's truly the most powerful thing that each and every one of us has." And as I think about the power of stories and activism, I think about the things I've heard activists say about organizing. Like Saul Alinsky, who said, "Change comes from power, and power comes from organization." And Adrienne Marie Brown talks about how organization grows out of stories. She writes, "In my experience, the best storytelling is the best organizing. It's rooted in a truth people have experienced, has some magic in it, and something to long for, and a moment of beauty. But it is co-created and it is lived. No one can see the end of it. That allows people to stay in the present moment and attend to the work before them with intention, seeing the story unfold with themselves in it, rather than directed with themselves outside the frame." And I think about another speculative fiction author, Ursula K. Le Guin, who wrote, "Storytelling is dangerous to those who profit from the way things are, because it has the power to show that the way things are is not permanent, not universal, not necessary." That is powerful. The way things are is not permanent, not universal, not necessary. One of the ways we learn that is by sharing our stories. I read a thing recently. I'm sorry, I don't have attribution for this. I have read so many things this past month. This thing said that part of the reason the left lost this election is that we have forgotten how to tell stories. Remember all those awful things Trump and Vance said? So many of them weren't true, that we focused on that being untrue, and stopped paying attention to them. So many of them were not true, but true or not, they were stories, and they drew people in. The thing I read said that our side works more with facts and policies, that even when those policies are effective, the strategy of simply sharing those is less inspiring than stories. It's food for thought. Genevieve gave us a great example of the brilliance of stories within a story. The example of the power of stories within a story. It was a story about the power As she read to us about beautiful and brilliant minds dreaming a thing and making it happen. If we want another world to be possible, this is where to start. Along with the anger and the sadness and the fear that we're feeling, we can also find and share our stories of joy and beauty and hope and success and winning. And we can make a space for other people's stories to emerge. We know how to do this already. And by that I mean we, this congregation. We know how to do this because we've been doing it. We just have to keep doing it and find new ways to do it and invite others to join us and learn from their stories about more and more ways to do it. There are 1,000 possible answers. And we can choose to be one of them. That is within our power to do. May it be so. May we be so.